Unlocking Potential is a project based at Maynooth University, Ireland, and is kindly supported by the Public Service Innovation Fund. Studies show that people with convictions are largely drawn from the same groups who are underrepresented in higher education. The aim of Unlocking Potential is to increase access for people with convictions, including prisoners and former prisoners. Over 6 episodes, we'll hear from a variety of voices who will share their experiences and perspectives on the role of universities and colleges in supporting fair access and creating safer communities. We will address questions like, why is fair access for people with convictions important? How can we make this happen? And who needs to be involved?
Welcome to this episode of the Unlocking Potential podcast. A key inspiration for this project came from the work of Unlock, an award-winning organization in the UK that provides a voice and support for people with convictions who are facing stigma and obstacles because of their criminal record. Of specific importance is their work on the Fair Chance Pledge for universities. To discuss this and the opportunities for our complementary work, I'm delighted to be joined by Rachel Tynan. Rachel is a policy and practice lead at Unlock and was awarded her PhD in sociology from Goldsmiths in 2018. She has published widely in this area and the broader criminal justice fields, including her book entitled Young Men's Experiences of Long-Term Imprisonment, Living Life, published by Routledge. Welcome, Rachel, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I suppose to start at the beginning, can you tell us a little bit about the Unlock organisation and the work you do?
Sure. So Unlock was founded as a charity 21 years ago. It was our 21st birthday this year, by a group of men who had all left prison and had found that despite having served their sentence, they were still facing stigma and discrimination. And effectively, that's why we exist today. That's our purpose, is to support people with criminal records who are facing stigma and discrimination because of their past. And it's interesting that many of the things that those guys were kind of experiencing back in those days haven't really changed, and in some cases have got worse. And I should say as well, we support all people with criminal records. So whilst we'd expect people with prison sentences in their past to kind of have some of the biggest obstacles to face, it's also the case that people with police cautions can struggle to get employment sometimes for the rest of their life as well. So what we've seen, I think, in the last perhaps 5 to 10 years or so, is a massive increase in the checking industry. So criminal records checks are a par for the course, asking questions, digital application forms and so on. The way that data is collected and used has had a big impact on the way that people with criminal records are viewed and their ability to access, particularly employment. So we run a helpline, which is run by peer volunteers, so all people with criminal records, managed by paid members of staff. And our helpline speaks to about 8,000 people a year. We have online resources to help the people that we're not able to speak to. We just simply, don't have the resource as a small charity. And about 1 million people a year use our online resources. And that's information about anything to do with a criminal record, how that can affect you for travel, employment, as I've mentioned, education, access to your children, joining a charity as a senior manager or a trustee, all sorts of things that, perhaps I'm not even aware of yet. Sometimes new things pop up and are a surprise to us. So there's lots and lots of ways that a criminal record can affect somebody in their life. And I guess we focus on employment and higher education more recently as two of the biggest barriers to people moving on, for all the reasons that we know. A job is really important, but access to higher education is about transformation. And I think I personally see that as being something that everyone should have the ability to access to realise their own potential.
It sounds like an incredible organisation. It's such a body of work and support services for, as you said, what is a small organisation, but a serious amount of reach. And I think it really speaks to, what this project is about as well, in the sense that, in another episode we spoke to Siobhan Cafferty about the idea of employment and the overlap between higher education and employment, especially for people with convictions. To hone in a little bit, just because, again, I'd love to talk so much about all aspects of the organization and your work, but the inspiration, we'll say, for the Unlocking Potential project really came from the Fair Chance Pledge, or a couple of different titles we've kind of bandied around with it. So could you tell us about the origins of that or and how it kind of developed into what it is today?
Yeah, sure. So the UCAS application form, you know, when it became digital as well, for a long time asked all applicants to disclose whether they had relevant unspent convictions. Provided a definition of relevant and included things like violent sexual offences, offences involving drug supply, and there are a number of others, I think, that were added over time as well. And what that did was it was just a tick box, you know, yes or no, have you got an unspent conviction for one of these offences? That information then went to the universities, and universities handled that in different ways. We know that some simply threw it away and paid no attention, a very, very small number. Some would then ask for further information, and so on, go through their own processes. So UCAS essentially didn't do a lot of things themselves with that information. And when the GDPR came in 2018, there was a big discussion about whether or not that information was sort of, there was a legal basis for UCAS to collect it. And for a long time, I think before my time at Unlock, there'd been a sort of push to changing that question, asking universities why, you know, what do you do with this information? How do you make sure that applicants aren't being unfairly excluded? And something we know from working with people over a long time is that simply asking that question acts as a deterrent. People with convictions will often not want to disclose because they will expect that they'll be discriminated against. So they just simply deselect themselves from that process. And the data actually from UCAS around who was ticking that box really showed that it wasn't really capturing very much about what was happening. Such a tiny number, I think less than, I think perhaps 1.5% was the most recent number there. And some of those were also people that had accidentally ticked the box. You know, we've all filled in forms too quickly when we've been in a hurry to get things in. And actually people were disclosing, yes, I've got a conviction, and actually they didn't have one. So we didn't really know very much from that information about who was and who wasn't applying. But it seems likely from sort of speaking to people through our work and through other pieces of research that have been done, that students with criminal records were being excluded, whether they were deselecting or whether they were sort of, unsure. I think the key thing there, and I think this might come up later in our discussion as well, and it's something that we talk about a lot, is that information wasn't being checked. So somebody with an unspent conviction that they decided not to share wasn't going to be assessed in any way. There was no way to kind of check the veracity of their ticking of the box or otherwise. So in terms of safeguarding, it's completely useless as a mechanism. And that was one of the arguments that I think ultimately perhaps made their kind of connection there with the GDPR, which is, what's the purpose of collecting this information? It's not for safeguarding. It's not for anything that's useful, because the information is not being verified, and therefore there's no purpose. There's no place for it. So then that box was removed. Great, you know, very sort of positive. However, that left universities in a position of sort of thinking, well, what do we do now? You know, many of them wanted to continue to collect the information because they have a strong belief that there is a safeguarding need to collect it. It's not, in our opinion, borne out by any evidence. If there is any, I'd be very delighted to see some. It's definitely an area that's of interest, but it isn't something that I've ever seen sort of, you know, justified. But we know that a group of universities wanted to continue asking and have done so, and they've continued to ask almost identical an almost identical question about relevant unspent convictions. But other universities started to look at that a little bit differently and started to think, well, actually, what is the purpose of it? How do we process this information from a practical and sort of legal point of view? And we started a project to kind of build on some of the work that we've done with UCAS and start to extend that with some of the universities that were at this transitional stage. So we worked with a small group of universities there to look at how they were making this transition, what decisions they were making, and how they would go forward with it. And two of those universities had done, I would say, a reasonable amount of work actually internally to look at that, and had come to some really positive decisions with applicants. And as a result of that, we sort of collectively, I think, developed the idea of this pledge. You know, it was something that Unlock wanted to do because we could see that as a flagship, really, I guess, for universities to say, look, this is good practice. This is what we think should be happening as a model for other organisations, including universities, but also wider, to let students and applicants know we will treat you fairly, you know, that we are an organisation, that, you know, an institution that you can trust. But I think wider than that as well, the student body you know, actually being able to see this is about social justice. This isn't about the inclusion or exclusion of criminals or people that might hurt us. It's about recognizing that people move on. And I think there's something really important there about the university, the place that it has in our culture and our society as a seat of learning. And there's lots of criticism of that, and we know that that's changing for all sorts of different reasons. But fundamentally, university is about learning, it's about opportunity, it's about change and growth. And actually being able, you know, as an applicant outside to look at that and say, oh, that's what that university is about. That's a badge of them sort of saying, yeah, we believe in that. I think it was quite a powerful one.
Yep, absolutely. There's so much there. I want to unpick a couple of them, if that's okay. And I think going right back to the start and something that's really fundamental to your work and our work also is this kind of inconsistency. So, you know, there is no set policy. Universities or higher education institutions often have quite ad hoc approaches to this that can be influenced by whoever was in authority at the time, or as we'll come to in a moment, this kind of idea of the kind of myth of data to perform some sort of safeguarding action. But that inconsistency really is, in my view, crying out for this best practice, this best practice approach that will give a template or an opportunity to see what is possible and how it works, rather than be left to rely on your own, you know, perhaps not very well informed for obvious reasons. I often think it's very important to be fair to people who work in different areas, particularly admissions and so on and so forth, where, you know, they're not engaged in some of these debates, understandably, because it's not necessarily their area, you know. So that kind of knowledge exchange, I think, is really important. And something that you mentioned, number one, that the your project, and indeed the aim of our project, is very much to work with the universities, you know, to develop on what's being done and, you know, tweak other areas. Because again, with those ad hoc policies, it might be a stroke of a pen to change something, or it might be good practice that just hasn't been formalized already. So I think that's really important to kind of work with the universities. But the big issue, and I think this speaks to whether philosophical but also very, very practical levels, is this idea of, you know, what is the function, you know, what is the underpinning myths of what this data is supposed to do in terms of if it's supposed to safeguard, how will it do so? Or is it a kind of retroactive fear of if something happens, we, and it comes out that we haven't been asking these questions, then, you know, even having non-applied data sitting somewhere will be enough to cover us. And I think some of these concerns feed into policy and get written into policy. And is that your experience in the UK?
Yeah, definitely. I think we can sort of, you can see a clear line really between Bishard, the Bishard inquiry, and the kind of the policy focus on using information to keep people safe. And the idea that if we knew something sooner, we could have prevented something from happening. And while that's true in some spheres, it's not true in everything. And it, I think what's happened is that that kind of that desire to prevent harm has also sometimes been corrupted by the fear of being in trouble for allowing harm to happen. There's this kind of risk and responsibilization sort of paradox, isn't there, where people are very keen to cover their own back. But sometimes that leads to a kind of disadvantage, but that's somehow more acceptable than the alternative, which is I might take a risk, somebody might do very well, but it could go wrong. So there's, to come back to your point, I think it's not about criticizing admissions teams and decision makers for the use of this information, because actually they don't have, none of us have the knowledge, actually. None of us can predict the future. Most risk prediction tools are faulty in one way or another. And so it's not really about breaking that link between predicting risk or not. It's about recognizing what the limitations of information are to predict risk, because actually people, even very people who are identified as having a lot of criminogenic risks, those risks reduce the longer they're in the community, the more stable the environment they're in, the more things they are engaged in the community, and a degree program or a job or a family environment are all things that are kind of mitigating those risks anyway. So excluding people from those things is ironically increasing their risk, but yet whilst I'm not having to be responsible for that risk, it's easier for me to push that person away. So I think it comes down to some things which are about policy and things that have changed in the way that the law has developed in the last 15, 20 years or so. But I think it's also that's become cultural. We've become risk averse. We've become afraid of getting in trouble. We've been very keen to blame others for things. And that, to kind of bring it perhaps to more recent and perhaps a bit too uncomfortable history, I think we can see a lot of those same themes playing out in the way that different parts of society have dealt with the pandemic. And this idea that we're responsible for our health, or the state's responsible, who's responsible, that, those questions haven't really been resolved in any sphere. So it's not surprising perhaps that they haven't been resolved in this sphere, which is one that exists, mostly in the dark.
Yeah, I think so. It's a really good analogy. And I think that, without straying too much into it, I think there's a lot of parallels there in terms of the role of data, the role of self-reporting, the role of filling out forms about whether it was quarantining or where that were never going to be enforceable or checked. But again, the very act of having such a practice was almost deemed to be enough to soothe people's concern or that kind of risk, even though it was not just faulty, but impossible to operate from the start. And I think that two things. Number one, that idea of risk prediction tools being faulty perhaps isn't as widely known as we might expect, because we're surrounded by them. And I think that that is a key discussion that many institutions would benefit from having, in terms of what is our role. Okay, we would like to be able to provide a safeguarding mechanism of some sort, but number one, as you said, it's not likely to have any impact in a real sense, and number two, is it the role of the university to put those in place, to cast such surveillance over their prospective students, when other bodies within society, which we could argue about back and forth, but they have been designated a role to decide who is free to live in the community, who is not, under what conditions, and so on. But at what point does a university step in and say, okay, we're going to add another layer to that? And the knock-on effects. And just to bring up one other thing you mentioned, and I do think that the social justice aspect of this is really not just principally important, but practically important, because I think in this project, and I'm sure in other aspects of your work, there could be a tendency for people to think, well, you're doing this out of a vocational sense. You want to do good in the world, and that's fine. But what about this? Isn't this? But ultimately, as we've just talked about, it's not an ideological, purely idea. It's an idea that we know that the practical implications of providing higher education, providing that protective factor against people being potentially involved in criminality or behaviors that they wish not to, you could have a very positive, almost higher chance of having a positive effect on someone's life, and then a very small chance of something that you are afraid of happening in that sense. But you will certainly have a very negative effect by putting a deterrent in place. And I think, while I definitely want to talk about, the data aspects and that kind of other practicalities, I am curious to know about some of the kind of successes or challenges the project has kind of faced along the way. Because again, I think we feel like we're a little bit, and I'm sure our listeners will feel that we're a little bit behind in the kind of implementation of this. And it'd be great to learn about areas that were successful or areas that perhaps might be challenges coming down the line?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think from what I know, I wouldn't say that you're behind. I think that sometimes it not having been thought about is itself being far ahead. You know, the fact that it hasn't come up as an issue means nobody's fiddled with it and made it bad. So that might be good. You know, if this work doesn't need to be done, that's great. I think what's been surprising to me actually through the course of the kind of work has been that there are some universities that portray themselves particularly as having, and I won't name any names, by the way, I'll tell you offline if you like, but we try not to do that because we try and build positive relationships. And because things are changing all the time and because of the things we've said, it's not about being critical, it's about trying to do better. But there are universities that portray themselves as being very social justice focused. They might have a human rights centre. They might have a strong focus on being rebels, or you know, whatever kind of way it is that they market themselves to students. They may do a lot of outreach. They may have a prison university partnership programme running. But then when it comes down to it, that's their bit of social justice. They don't want to change how they interact with everyday applicants or how they support students with criminal records and associated needs. You know, it's not every student with a criminal record has other needs, but there will be students who happen to have a criminal record and have other needs for various reasons, of course. So I think that's been the hypocrisy, I suppose, would be a way to say that, is it's sometimes really surprising. And I think the other thing sort of related to that, but again, not a criticism really at all, but that there are many academics that are very positive about what their institution does who are really surprised when they find out that their institution is not very good at this at all. And I think that kind of that disconnect perhaps between academia and the management and the marketing of the university is it a challenge? Perhaps not in some ways, because, you know, we're working with the part of the university we're working with. But it's interesting, I guess, intellectually to think about the way that a university functions at this point in time. And I guess the relationship between different forms of knowledge, actually. So lots of kind of criminological work around access to education and the role and function and sort of, you know, positive impact of education. But that those institutions where that great work is happening are themselves part of the problem. I think that's quite fascinating.
I think that is fascinating, and to pick up on a couple of things, and I suppose you're kind of saying it from your interaction with them, but I've had that a little bit from interacting with some of former and current students in this podcast and elsewhere. But one thing that comes across very strongly is the idea that getting to know the university that you may, or higher education institution that you may want to apply to, can go a long way, because you know, the rhetoric and the marketing and so on, and you know, we have this program and that program, are very to the fore. But some students have said that when they got there, they had a very different sense of being accepted or welcomed or otherwise, and that had a very strong sense of being more holistically welcomed in everyday life, rather than just within this kind of siloed outreach sphere, you know. And I think that's really important, not just for policy, but for the experience. One of the things that, you know, I think comes across very well in the Unlock material and literature is that, you know, it's not just about policy, that it has to feel fair, you know, that legitimacy has to be experienced, not just on paper. And I do think that many of those, and having been involved in different projects within universities, such as a module in prison education and so on, I think there is a danger that these projects can be a safe, exclusive outreach that doesn't really extend or interact with other aspects of the university. And it often falls to criminology or sociology departments, because that's what they do. But you know, what we always think is important is that the prospective students here might want to do maths. They're not, you know, this is not just about social sciences or particular programs that people might want to do. And the same reverse implications are for supporting staff who, you know, may never enter their head that one of their students may have a criminal conviction, and it shouldn't, but sometimes it can impact on the student experience. Mm-hmm. So that's fascinating. And again, every time we have a topic, I think we could discuss it more. But there's one thing that I did want to touch on in a specific area, and this is something that's kind of changing here and there, I know in Scotland as well, and that's the kind of policy and discourse around spent convictions. And I know this is part of a big element of your work. And is it something that you see changing, or something that you have kind of had difficulty with throughout the project?
I would say it's not something that's necessarily been a difficulty throughout this particular project. I guess one of the levers for sort of engaging with universities around how they use data is to point out that if convictions become spent during the course of the degree program or whatever program it is, you'll have to delete them, because continuing to hold them would be unlawful. So that's sometimes a useful way to explain that it's not very helpful to retain information. But I guess the challenge for many universities is they're thinking about the longer term sentences. That's where their worries and concerns are. And so thinking about spent convictions is not, in England, there are sentences of more than 4 years can't become spent at the moment. It hasn't been a relevant consideration for most of them. But in the broader sense, yes, I think it is changing. I think it was really, really good to see the changes that Scotland made. And they have a mechanism in their legislation for future, changes to be a little bit more simply made, I think, which is that there can be some sort of panel or review mechanism for all convictions to be considered. So those that cannot currently become spent can at some point in the future. This doesn't exist yet, but it's a sort of a caveat in the legislation for it to be possible. And we'd like to see that here, so that currently sentences of over 4 years can't become spent. The sentencing bill proposes that sentences of over 4 years will become spent for convictions that aren't sexual, violent or terror related. That's a bit of a misnomer. There's a really big list of offences that won't become spent under Schedule 15 of the Criminal Justice Act 2003, if anybody wants to spend time reading that. I think the problem with that, the problem with all sorts of blanket cutoffs, is there are always going to be injustices at the margins of those. So, we speak to people with all sorts of convictions, all sorts of ages, all sorts of backgrounds, circumstances and everything else. Is somebody, and this is a real case, a person who, more than 20 years ago had a conviction for armed robbery. He's been in work ever since, because he started work at a time when people didn't ask and didn't do DBS checks. 20 odd years later, the firm brought in a policy of doing DBS checks, and he had to disclose his unspent conviction, and they paid him off and let him go because they said, what if people find out? Now, does that make sense? Is he a person who should never have a conviction become spent? Is he dangerous? He's been working in a senior role in his organization for a number of years now, been to the colleagues' weddings and christenings and everything else. But how interesting, no matter how well they knew him, as soon as they learned this about him, this guilty knowledge, they had to let him go, push him out. Young people who've been involved in gang violence, who have gone on to put their life on a totally different track, who again will never be able to not disclose that they have a conviction. I'm just not sure that that's really keeping us safe. There's no evidence that it's keeping us safe. And I can't see their justification for keeping it other than the public fear of what that means. And I think we can see in the last, 12 months or so that this piece of legislation has been mooted and discussed. There is a framing of the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, which is the law that enables convictions to become spent, as a piece of public protection legislation. People are kept safe because criminals have to disclose their crimes for a period of years. Well, no, that's not the case. In Israel, there's not this kind of disclosure, and there's much lower reoffending rates, the same in Norway, the same in the Netherlands. I could kind of go on, but there isn't actually a link. And this comes back to the same sort of issues in universities, really. There's a perception that disclosure keeps people safe. And no wonder universities think this, because the government portrays this. But it just simply isn't the case. So our position is that we think that all convictions should be able to become spent over a period of time, that the decisions about that time period should be evidence-led, which they're not currently, And that if there have to be convictions which can't become automatically spent, there should be a review body similar to, say, the parole board that can make a decision. So you have a quasi-judicial process, as they do in France and many other countries, where a person makes an application, pays a fee and says, these are the things I've done since my conviction. You know, can it be reconsidered, kind of thing. So it's a sort of a community rehabilitation process, really.
That's really very much... covers a lot of the questions I was going to follow up with.
Sorry.
Which was great. But no, I think that it is so interesting because, you know, as we've said before, you know, universities don't exist in a vacuum. You know, that this idea that admissions policies or different areas of universities are very much feeding on government guidance or societal myths or norms and so on, but you know the evidence that society is safeguarded or kept safe by these are no more reliable than those that are specifically applied to university campuses. And I think that the university campus as a space carries a certain kind of mythology as well, that you know that this is a place where risk is increased in certain areas, or you know, vulnerability is increased, and so on and so forth. So it's almost creates this virtual gated community, despite the open campus policies and so on. Mm-hmm. And one thing that was brought up there, and I think this really goes to the heart of, you know, the policy versus practice, and we've always said that the students or prospective students are really at the heart of this project, and some of the students who have already expressed their experiences on the podcast and elsewhere have really hit upon the idea about the DBS check in the UK, or what's called a Garda vetting check here. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's two elements that are really problematic. And number one is the kind of misinformation about what exactly those checks are for and what exactly they can be used for. And the other side, which is somewhat more intangible, but just as real, and that's the kind of emotional, visceral response to these kind of checks that even with a good degree of information still affect people so much. So, and I think it kind of goes back to what you were saying about in the absence of safeguarding, it just kind of becomes a perpetual punishment. You know, how long do people have to be punished for, like the man you gave an example of there? And in your experience, have people discussed the DBS checks much, or is it something that people have a good sense of what they're for and kind of and are less concerned about for that reason?
In relation to universities, do you mean, or more generally? No, I would say no. So I think there is an awareness that for, you know, the majority of courses, unregulated courses, if you like, that there is no DBS check. So the kind of the question seems to stand in for any sort of checking. And there seems to be a reluctance to kind of acknowledge that this information can't be checked. I think amongst regulated courses and admissions there often involves people from the departments of social work, medicine, etc. There is a better understanding, I think, of what the enhanced check means, in that it discloses all spent, unspent convictions, criminal records, and can disclose any police information if the police think it's relevant. That's very kind of, you know, broad brush. But I think there is still a perception in universities that a clear DBS check is required to enter the professions, or that you can pass a DBS check when you've passed the DBS check process. And we hear that with employers as well. And it's just a lack of understanding of what it really means, I think. But I think that often we see that universities are very restrictive around, you know, applicants to regulated programs, and that the professions are less so in some ways, which is an interesting sort of dilemma in itself. So there was a case in England a couple of years ago of a surgeon who used a type of laser tool, I think it was. I'm not a surgeon, obviously. And he wrote his initials on a patient's liver, and he was prosecuted for that. And I think he may have admitted to it, but he was prosecuted anyway. He was convicted of that. And he has recently been assessed by the GMC, and they've said he's fit to practice. And now I'm not, it's not for me to say whether he is or not. I don't have that expertise. I don't want people to kind of, you know, think I'm questioning that decision. I'm definitely not. But I think it shows a very different set of principles that are being applied, because if he as a student had been convicted of common assault, which is what he's convicted of in the last 2 years or so, and he was disclosing that to become, you know, to get onto a program in medicine or, you know, related profession, he would probably find that difficult to get onto a university program in the UK. In England, certainly. And there's this kind of disconnect there, isn't there, about who we think is valuable within a professional context. And so I think it's partly about the DBS check, but it's about the information that discloses and the ability to put that into context. And I think universities find that difficult, and they're very reputation focused, which again is very, very understandable. But the question is always for me, how do people find that information out? You're worried about people finding out, what if this guy or this woman joins our program and they find out they've got this conviction, how will they, you know?
And that's a really interesting point, because again, to kind of flip it to the student experience, and then I think this is something that is a major concern for students, whether they disclose to their peers or to their the staff and so on and so forth. And in a lot of cases, students have found that their peers are incredibly supportive and so on and so forth. But it is interesting that the reputational protection from the university side is almost a preferred gag on the students, because again, the universities aren't going to tell anyone that they have allowed someone in for whatever past conviction, but they've no way of ensuring that the student won't tell people. So they almost say, well, you can't come in case you want to disclose or be open with anyone. So again, it's kind of the perhaps unintended consequences of these kind of decisions made for perhaps the wrong outcomes, shall we say. And I think that in another kind of perhaps perverse unintended consequence is that, you know, when you were speaking about the spent convictions policy and the fact that a beneficial outcome might be that a board would review all convictions, perhaps. But what we have in some universities is where a board of people who have no experience in the area end up reviewing students. So in a kind of a twisted way, students are going through a review process to see if, as you properly put it, that if they pass the entry exam based on very little substantive evidence or very little understanding, almost like a scorecard of the Vicarda vetting. And I know one particular student who was in this podcast, so won't mind me talking about it, had a large number of small scale convictions, but, you know, was very terrified, anxious about the fact that it would be, you know, as long as your arm, no violence or and so on and so forth, but just incredibly long conviction sheet, and thought that that would be enough to ruin their chances. Whereas even when they were informed that this was merely a matter of fact check to say what is on it, and it cannot be used officially to not allow someone in, that gut reaction is still there, you know, about when waiting for that letter to come through the door and so on and so forth. So I appreciate that we are coming towards the end, but I was wondering about, I suppose, the future plans, and I'm certainly thinking of future synergies between the two projects and the two and your organization and so on. So what would you see as the kind of next step for this project or your kind of broader work?
So we are now beginning a second phase of our work with universities. Sort of in the last couple of months, we've started to kind of work on that. And we're looking primarily, I think, at expanding the pledge So making sure that more students are aware of it, making sure that the information that universities collect and use is more transparent for applicants, to try to encourage applicants to make those applications and move forward with their plans and their futures. But also to continue to work with university to, I guess, benchmark some of those. What does good practice really look like? We know what it should look like, but it's more than just admissions. It's also about support for that student, whatever form that might take. In the same way that, you know, the student support services are available through the life of the programme for various students. Some people will know they have support needs going in. Others will encounter them as they come along. It's about making sure that individual parts of that journey, that student journey, have at least an awareness, so that nobody's ever going to, I don't know, student finance because they need, you know, financial help. And if for the first time is having to disclose, actually, I have an unspent conviction, so I can't apply for this grant or whatever it might be. And is sort of met with, you know, the wide eyes and the, oh no, what does this mean? So that there's a kind of a, you know, that there's an underlying threat where we all know what this means, and we might not encounter it very often, but we know what to do when that happens. So that's a kind of a key piece of work for us. And then I think looking further ahead at what the kind of role of the university is in influencing positive change more widely. So universities have great relationships with employers through their careers teams. How do they help graduates with convictions move forward into employment? Because we know that's another huge barrier. And there's some research, quite recent research from the US, which shows that graduates with convictions, felony convictions, are 2.5 times more likely to be rejected for a job role, which is about the same as non-graduates with felony convictions. So the degree doesn't balance out the past at all. And that's really problematic, I think. So I feel a sort of sense of responsibility there, that I'm encouraging universities to allow people in. What if they all do that, but then at the end everyone's got a huge debt and then they still can't get a graduate job? I mean, that's a key kind of part of my thinking for the future of how we sort of deal with this work. But ultimately I think it is about raising awareness and continuing to challenge these perceptions about what information can tell us about, what does the past tell us about the future, in essence.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because one of the things that we talk about a lot in this project and we try and articulate in the podcast is that while we talk a lot about admissions, you know, admissions is only step one. You know, degrees are long marathons for most students, but you know, for different students with different needs, the support needs to happen throughout. And as you said, to make staff and everyone throughout completely comfortable with the idea that they may encounter somebody with a specific set of needs related to convictions and maybe other overlapping needs. But one area that I think would be definitely in the future of this project as well is that, you know, what happens afterwards, getting into university, getting through university and getting out. And I think your natural work with employment is really beneficial, and I suppose our partnership with Working to Change, the Working to Change initiative, is looking to do that, because again, as you said, there's no point, especially in the UK, of leaving university with a big debt and your chances haven't significantly improved. So that's a really insightful area to be looking into, and I wish you well in that. That does bring us to the end of another episode of the Unlocking Potential podcast. Thanks again to our guest, Rachel Tynan, for sharing her insight and work with Unlock. The web address for Unlock is unlock.org.uk, and a link is also available on the project website at unlockpotential.ie. Don't forget to subscribe and look out for the next and final episode of this series of the Unlocking Potential podcast. Thanks for listening, and mind yourselves. My Lab, Maynooth University Innovation Lab, and diverse partners across education.